Welcome to Coast to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett, sitting in for the indefatigable George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Kung Hei Fat Choi, Happy Chinese New Year to all our Chinese listeners and friends. We are broadcasting live from Coast to Coast's affiliate in Toronto, Canada on AM 640, nestled here on the shores of Lake Ontario. And thank you so much for allowing me into your home, your living room, your bedroom, whatever the case may be. Don't worry, I'm a Canadian, so I always take off my shoes before entering the home. You know, Americans and Canadians are a lot alike, but there are two sort of immediate ways you know if you're in Canada. You walk into a Canadian home and there's always a big pile of shoes at the door. The other big difference, in Canada, milk comes in bags. That's right, bags. You drive north of the 49th parallel and that's it. Not a jug of milk to be found anywhere. Milk in bags, shoes by the doors. Welcome to the Great White North. Of course, Canada's other major export these days seems to be the polar vortex. And to our American neighbors, especially in the southern U.S., who woke up one morning to snow and the concept of ice scrapers and earmuffs, sorry about that. Incidentally, if you go to the news in the news section on Coast to Coast AM, there's a great interactive video of the polar vortex. And on the site, you can zoom in and out of different areas on Earth and visualize the winds of the polar vortex at different altitudes. And I have to say, it's actually rather hypnotic to look at this thing. I've been staring at it here in the studio for a while. It's quite beautiful, of course, but this polar vortex has left many of us in a deep freeze. So wherever you are tonight, this morning, I hope you're warm and dry. And let's see if we can't help you forget about January and the deep freeze or drought, as the case may be. And let's ease on into February and hope for better weather ahead. Of course, we'll find out soon. Groundhog Day, just 2 days away. And if he sees his shadow, what's the deal, right? Six more days of winter, no shadow, early spring. Of course, groundhogs are a lot like psychics. After they make their predictions, they just disappear. Say, are you a fan of horror films like I am? Science fiction? Fantasy? How about The Twilight Zone? What about the rock band Kiss? I have it on good authority. There are a lot of Kiss Army members out there who are big Coast to Coast fans. And my guest tonight on Coast to Coast is going to tie all of these seemingly disparate subjects together over the next couple of hours. He's the editor of several horror film magazines. He was also the editor of the official fanzine for Kiss. It was called Kiss Monster Magazine. And as it turns out, he and Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley of Kiss share a love of the Twilight Zone. And my guest also has a book coming out, an episode-by-episode guide to Rod Serling's masterpiece. And if that's not enough, he's just completed his second feature film. This one is called The Queen of Blood. And wait till you hear how we made it. You're about to meet the editor of Fangoria Magazine, a filmmaker, author, composer, a walking, talking encyclopedia when it comes to the Twilight Zone, and a long, proud member of the Kiss Army. Chris Alexander, when Coast to Coast AM continues, Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Serrett with you, sitting in for George Norrie. Chris Alexander is a Canadian-based, internationally published writer, filmmaker, and editor-in-chief of such magazines as Fangoria, Gore Zone, and Full Moon Entertainment's house magazine, Delirium. As a filmmaker, he's the writer, director, and composer of the multi-award-winning vampire film Blood for Irina and its upcoming follow-up sequel, Queen of Blood. As a journalist, he was a columnist for Rue Morgue magazine for 6 years before taking over as editor-in-chief of iconic New York City-based horror periodical Fangoria in 2009. He was the editor of Kiss Monster, the official album and tour magazine of the band Kiss, and will be editing the new official Kiss magazine in 2014. He's written thousands of feature articles in various publications and periodicals and is currently at work on his second book, The Twilight Zone Legacy, coming soon from Bear Manor Media. Chris Alexander, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
It is an absolute thrill. to be on this show, Mr. Sarrett. So thank you for having me. I just had a really surreal moment because as I'm sitting here preparing to speak to you and your listeners, I have on my television in front of me Hammer's 1971 vampire classic, Twins of Evil, with Peter Cushing. And I have the volume off. So as the show is coming in, lo and behold, there's Giorgio Moroder's score for Midnight Express pulsing in the background, while scenes of Cushing chasing nubile vampires through the forest with a cross. It was a very surreal, outrageous moment, so I thank you for that.
What did Harry Dean Stanton say in The Repo Man? Interconnecting lattices of coincidence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There you are. Listen, I have to ask you about Fangoria magazine. Very impressive magazine, very glossy. Congratulations. It's one of those magazines that you want to buy two copies. One to read, you know, it's a well-thumbed copy, and then the other one you want to preserve and maybe frame it. The artwork is wonderful. Tell me a little bit about how you, I mean, this must have been, you know, your fantasy come true, to be editor-in-chief of one of the premier horror magazines in the world.
Well, it's, you know, everything I do is kind of my fantasy come true. And I always have to pinch myself that this is actually real. Because when I was little, I mean, horror movies and Kiss, and well, I guess we'll get to all that, but I've always been my window to the world and my obsession since I was 3 years old. This is the truth. I saw, when I was in the library with my dad, it was the Eatonville Library in Etobicoke, Ontario. And the record section for adults was very close to the children's section. And I saw a copy of Kiss's 1977 album, Love Gun, on the shelf. And I don't know if you've ever seen that cover. A quick Google search will fix that if you haven't. But the cover's a painted image of the band in leather and chains standing on this kind of gothic staircase with these columns beside them. And around them are these pasty, emaciated vampire women kind of swooning at their feet, you know, these undead ghostly groupies. And Gene Simmons is obviously there over to the left of the image, and his head is back and he's got fangs. So I didn't know what I was looking at. You know, I'm 3 years old. I hadn't even started kindergarten yet. And I was kind of having this double awakening, this interest in this kind of arcane imagery. And as well, looking at women in this kind of light. So it was very, very strange. So from that point on, it was all about monsters, Dracula, Kiss, horror. And by the time I was old enough to reach the newsstands, it was Fangoria. I think it was issue number 20. I want to say it was issue number 27 or 28. This is back in about 1983, I guess it was. I picked up a copy of Fangoria magazine, and they used to have a fold-out gatefold poster in the front called Scream Greats. And I opened that poster up to see a burnt woman falling out of a dryer from the movie My Bloody Valentine. Of course, I didn't know the movie. I hadn't seen it. But it was the imagery. It shocked me. And I knew I wasn't supposed to be looking at this. Of course, after that, that's all I could think about. And when I was 8...
Ah, yes, Forbidden Fruit.
Forbidden Fruit. And that's how it got all of us. If you're a horror fan, if you're in this secret club, it was always, this was my punk rock. This was my entry into this kind of forbidden world. So eventually I was able to purchase copies of Fangoria with allowance, or people would buy them for me. I had luckily a somewhat liberal household growing up. And this was my window to this very strange, magical world of monsters and make-believe and special effects. And it was the pulling back the curtain and seeing the wizard behind there operating his machinery. So it was educational. It was stimulated my id. It was everything to me. So, you know, flash forward these many years later, it wasn't just by happy accident this happened. There kind of was a clear trajectory in every move I made to kind of get to where I got. But the fact that I am steering this boat and have been for almost 5 years is pretty outrageous. It's pretty bizarre. But very
Chris Alexander, editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine here on Coast to Coast AM. Now, Chris, the magazine has been around for, what, 35, 36 years?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the demographic. I mean, who is reading Fangoria?
Well, it's a tricky demographic because, you know, this is one of my challenges as editor now, 35 years later, is to find out who my audience is. And the fact is, my audience is, you know, 60-year-old guys have been reading this thing since 79. And their kids, and maybe even their grandkids. So you're looking at anywhere between 12 and 60, maybe even beyond that. I don't know. If you're a horror fan, Fangoria is the Bible. I mean, that's just the way it is. So the challenge in creating this magazine and editing it and writing it, which I do a great deal of, is finding that language, that middle ground language, where you're speaking to the young kid who's just discovering this for the first time. So you're speaking to him as his entry drug into this, and you're trying to speak to the 60-year-old guy, not insult his intelligence. So you're trying to kind of veer that middle ground language, which is a bit of a challenge. Obviously, we can fall back on some juicy pictures that speak louder than any words could ever speak.
Well, you mentioned the Hammer films, Chris, and I grew up watching the Hammer films. Christopher Lee, for me, is the only Dracula.
Yeah.
But you've got three generations of readers. You've probably got you know, the Hammer type, the fans of Hammer films. And then you've got the younger demo, which I'm guessing might be attracted to more of the slasher type films. How do you satisfy both?
Well, it's I don't know if the younger generation is necessarily, there's so much out there right now. And you know, the model has changed so radically, very quickly in the last few years, in the sense that, you know, a myriad of entertainments are available to us at any time. And that goes for horror movies as well. Every country, every culture offers a different kind of commercial horror film. And you can see them all anytime, anywhere, online, right? It's all there. So the kinds of things, you know, when I was a kid, yeah, I mean, we had Friday the 13th and Halloween 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We had Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, these were quasi-slasher films. They were body count movies. And this was commercial. So whatever was commercial, Hollywood would ride that wave. The things that we got were kind of given to us. You know, we had to really search. I remember it was kind of, I always fancied myself as kind of a junior Indiana Jones going into the video store, trying to find the different offbeat stuff as opposed to the stuff the studio was trying to, you know, throw down my throat. It's radically different now in that, you know, it's easier to find this stuff. So kids today, you'd be surprised, are not just necessarily swallowing what's at the multiplex anymore. They're looking for all kinds of different esoteric, strange horror that's available to them at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, I always say that, you know, maybe Saw 4 does really well at the box office, but that's not because horror fans are going to see it. That's because it's a date movie. You know, it's the girl taking their boyfriend to see this movie. Maybe neither of them like horror films, but horror films have always tread that line between sexuality and thrill. And, you know, those are date movies, not necessarily horror fan movies.
Well, Fangoria, as you say, has become sort of the Bible. And I'm guessing then there must be a lot of people in Hollywood, actors who are in a lot of these films that, you know, that look to Fangoria. I mean, do you have a lot of fans from the acting world that are part of your readership?
If you're, you know, this goes for me, this goes for anyone. If you're a horror fan, and I'm not talking about a casual viewer who may or may not enjoy the odd film that deals with the macabre. I'm talking about an ardent, knuckle-dragging, obsessive horror fan like I've been my entire life. If you're in that club, you're in it for life. Whether you want to be or not, you are. And so they, you know, these guys are everywhere. They're just, you know, they're omnipresent. And, you know, we speak to all these guys.
Well, give me for instance, who's someone, you know, that we would know instantly by the name that is a big fan of Fangoria?
It is, again, a secret society out there. So in my adventures as editor of Fangoria, it's been my mandate. I think the first thing from day one was to, you know, to change the rhythm a little bit of the magazine and, you know, overturn rocks that maybe you wouldn't necessarily consider looking under when it comes to the genre. And being a KISS fan, obviously, a bit of a self-indulgent move on the surface, but underneath that, a practical one, because I knew the KISS army was legion. So commercially, knowing that if you put KISS, marry KISS and Fangoria together, you're going to get a whole new demographic that's going to look at your magazine, purchase the magazine, speak about the magazine. So loving KISS and having Gene Simmons be my first famous monster, really, you know, pre-Christopher Lee, pre-Bela Lugosi, pre-all these guys. First thing I did was contact Gene Simmons and say to him, listen, I want to put you on the cover of the magazine. I know your story, because Gene's story is my story in a different way, but it's the same kind of deal. And you'll find this again with a lot of lifelong horror fans. You know, Gene came from Haifa as a child, couldn't speak the language, and was very shy and ignorant, and learned about American culture, pop culture, fantasy, science fiction, literature. and learned the English language from watching late night television, and was primarily attracted to stories about the outsider, the other, because he himself felt that way. So Universal Monster Movies late at night and The Twilight Zone. Those were the two things that spoke to him loudest. So my concept was to get Gene and I together, and sit down and chat, but not about KISS, not about the merchandising, not about all the stuff that, you know, the sound bites that he's famous for, but just to talk about monsters and horror movies and the attraction of such, and his personal relationship with monsters, and how he really found the American dream, if you trace all the roads back to it, because of this passion for the arcane. So it was a great chat, a great interview. I stuck Gene on the cover, did a kind of mock-up Basil Gogo's painted cover. It sold through the roof. It was controversial among horror fans, of course, because Gene is not necessarily the most likely choice to put on the cover of Fangoria.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how that went over. It's controversial. Why was it controversial?
And horror fans love to fight. They love drama. And they love it. And obviously you want that, because there's no such thing as bad press. And so, you know, the KISS fans loved it. And you'll find in the horror community, a lot of horror fans are KISS fans. And to me, that's a no-brainer. I mean, Gene Simmons is one of the outside of Alice Cooper, is maybe Screaming Jay Hawkins, is the god of shock rock. You know, he's up on stage, gigantic Godzilla boots, spitting blood everywhere, breathing fire. He is a living, breathing monster, you know. And he was the guy that, you know, without Gene, there'd be no Marilyn Manson. There wouldn't have been all this wave of bizarre, theatrical rock and roll. So to me, it's a no-brainer. But for a lot of young guys, Gene Simmons is just that idiot on A&E with his family. You know, they don't get it. So, you know, part of the mission of putting him on the cover was also to educate to some degree too. But, you know, a lot of horror fans were not too keen on that. A lot of lifelong Fangle fans were a little bit confused, and I had to really go there on the front lines and defend my choice, which I always do. And at the end of the day, it kind of defined what I do with the magazine. That's you know, take chances, and also put my own personal stamp on that, because I firmly believe, as the editor of a magazine, a fan magazine, you have to be a fan, and you have to defend your choices, and you have to have your heart in it, and you have to be passionate about your subject. Otherwise,
absolutely,
no
absolutely, and you can't fake that.
You can't fake it. You can't phony it up, and you fans know. And horror fans are very sensitive to that. If you're phony, they're very aware of that.
We'll come back to KISS, because Gene Simmons, whom you just mentioned, plays a rather significant role in an upcoming book that you're writing about the Twilight Zone, because, as you mentioned, you two share that passion, and we'll get into the Twilight Zone. But I want to talk a little bit more about some of the fans that reach out to you in terms of, you know, your readership at Fangoria. Who are some of the others that maybe from Hollywood adore Fangoria magazine?
Yeah, I mean, with Fango, again, as I mentioned, it's the secret society, and every walk of life, from Prince to Pauper, if you're a horror fan, you're all on the same plane. You're all buddies. This is true. It's very clandestine. It's very tribal. And you'll find these fans in the most unlikeliest places. So, I mean, one of the other great thrills of my life was meeting Nicolas Cage, who, again, you would not think of this guy to be a likely choice to be in Fangoria magazine, perhaps. But the deal with Cage is that he's the same way. He lives, eats, and breathes this stuff. He loves horror movies. So when it was Ghost Rider 2, Spirit of Vengeance, about 2 years ago. That movie was on the cusp of coming out. And again, I thought, well, this guy would be a great interview, because Cage is nuts. And even in Cage's non-horror movies, he always feels like he's channeling some kind of intensity that you only find in the horror genre. He's almost like this alien entity spat. Even in romantic comedies, he clearly does not belong in these movies.
No, he's a very unlikely leading man, but it works. Whatever he's got, it works.
Yeah, there's some sort of bizarre dichotomy there. So I contacted him. He invited me to his island in the Bahamas. It was one of those incredible professional adventures of my life.
He's got an island?
Well, it's like he used to actually have a huge island. He had he had some tax troubles a few years ago, and he had to sell off some castles and comics. But he's on Paradise Island in the Bahamas, and he owns a good chunk of this kind of cove, right? So he's in this very private, secluded area of this island. So he invites me to his island, and I fly into the Bahamas, and I had this mission where I had to find this secret dock. And I can't mention the dock, obviously, because I have to keep it all very, very hush-hush. So it's very, very very, very exciting. So I end up at this dock, and this guy picks me up in this boat and drives me to this island, and there's Cage standing there with a full beard. You know, he'd just been kind of bumming around this island with his kid. And he has this gigantic courtyard. He invites me to his courtyard, and the two of us are there, and spread out on the table in front of us are tons and tons of Hammer horror DVDs.
Now, Hammer DVD. Okay, let me just jump in here, Chris. We'll just step away here for a moment. You're on an island with Nicolas Cage. Okay, you've set the scene nicely. When we come back, we'll find out what happened with Fangoria magazine fan Nicolas Cage and my guest, the editor-in-chief of the aforementioned Fangoria, Chris Alexander, Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Back with more in a moment. All right, Chris Alexander is with us. He is the editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine, also has been the editor of the official fanzine of Kiss, the rock band Kiss, and they have another fanzine coming out sometime this year. We'll talk about that as well. When we left Chris, we were on an island with Nicolas Cage, who is a huge Fangoria magazine fan, horror fan, Twilight Zone fan. We'll get into all of that. We'll talk about Rod Serling, his life and times, and the masterpiece, 5 seasons of The Twilight Zone, every one a gem. All that coming up when Coast to Coast AM returns right after this. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM, broadcasting from Toronto's, or Coast to Coast's affiliate in Toronto, AM 640. Chris Alexander is on the line, the editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine, and we'll make the phone lines available to you all after the top of the hour coming up here. But Chris, you were on this island, Paradise Island, with Nicolas Cage, who, as it turns out, is a huge, not only a horror fan, obviously, has appeared in some great horror films, but also a huge fan of Fangoria. So he calls you to this island. He summons you.
Yeah, he summons me, yeah. So it was very, as I mentioned, you know, you recapped the scene quite nicely. So I'm summoned to this island, and literally under cover of night as I flew in to Paradise Island. Well, I didn't fly into Paradise Island. I had to make my way to a secret dock to meet a man in a boat that would take me to Nicolas Cage.
Isn't this a scene from the Island of Dr. Moreau?
It was very, you know, obviously me loving this stuff since I was a child. I'm 12 years old forever, so my mind's always veering. I'm the main star of my own personal bizarre horror film, so my mind is always veering in this way, and I'm always spinning this yarn as I'm moving through these little adventures, right? So I get taken and whisked away to this island, and lo and behold, there's Cage with full beard on the island, and hello, welcome. And he brings me to his courtyard, and on his giant table in front of us, he has all his Hammer horror movies spread out to show me, you know, to prove to me, to testify that we are brothers under the skin. We are the same. We love the same thing. So we spend the first hour drinking red wine, eating bizarre scrambled eggs, souffles, and different things, and talking about how the two of us would love to remake the film Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, which was Terrence Fisher's last Frankenstein movie and one of the last gasps of Hammer Studios and one of the most underrated Hammer films. So we bonded on that level very quickly. Suddenly, out of nowhere, his manservant brings a giant sea snail, a huge thing, about the size of half your torso. And Cage suggests that in honor of Fangoria, he's going
Nicely
to get
done.
His manservant.
Nice impression, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you. He's going to get his manservant armed with axe to hack this thing apart, pull out the snail's penis, and the two of us can eat the snail's penis together because this is a kind of Viagra. And, you know, part of me is absolutely amused by this, wondering if it's some sort of shtick. The other part of me is wondering if Cage really is exactly as lunatic as the media perceives him. But either way, I'm enjoying the hell out of this. And I have this all on video, and if someone emails me at chris@fangoria.com, I'd be happy to share the video. The man hacks the snail apart, pulls out the penis, and the penis is black. And I sent it back. I refused to eat the penis, which was fine. So carry on.
A little undercooked. A little undercooked for your liking.
It was a little bit too much. I was on the fence about eating the penis to begin with, but that dark, it just didn't seem. It just seemed wrong. So refused that, and then we carry on with our elephantine interview. It was absolutely a bizarre, exciting experience, and lots of laughs, and talking about all the work and his points that no matter what movie he is in, he brings horror to all these roles. And this is true. If you look at anything from Leaving Las Vegas to his more overt stuff in Vampire's Kiss, bugging his eyes and pretending he's Renfield, he brings this kind of element of the outsider and the other to everything he does, whether he wants to or not. It's just naturally there. So it was really interesting to kind of dissect the performances for the purpose of this interview. So we're talking, and then out of nowhere, this gigantic rooster shows up, just starts strutting away in front of me. It's this huge thing just pops into the courtyard. And another manservant comes along and wrestles it to the ground, at which point Cage suggests that we sacrifice it in a voodoo ritual. Do you know Obea? We can cut its throat, and we bathe in the blood. So, you know, again, I'm not sure how much I'm being played here or what's going on, but it was surreal, it was exciting, and we did a two-part interview in Fangoria that reflected everything I just told you right now without the cool impression.
So he was angling for a cover story, basically.
I gave it to him. The man deserved it. And a few months later, you know, Ghost Rider 2 comes out. And, you know, to be perfectly frank, although I've warmed to the movie since on cable, some movies play better on the small screen than they do theatrically. The movie bombed. Wasn't that great? Felt bad for the guy. But we threw him a private party in New York City in Manhattan for 200 of his biggest fans, and it was really, really cool and fun to celebrate the cover story. So it was just one of those amazing, bizarre experiences where two worlds collide that shouldn't be colliding, and yet do, with very interesting and successful results.
Okay, I want to talk about The Twilight Zone, obviously, and I know people listening want to talk about The Twilight Zone, and I'm sure we'll take some calls about The Twilight Zone after the top of the hour, but I got to get back to the Hammer films, because that, you know, that's... I dined out on the Hammer films as a young man. And tell me about Christopher Lee, because for me, again, it's a very personal thing, right? The world is divided into two camps. You're either, it's Bela Lugosi or it's Christopher Lee. I'm in the Lee camp. Have you ever met him? What's he like?
No. And, you know, you're right. This is something Gene Simmons is wanting to quote, is that your perspective on the ride depends on when you get on the train. And you're right, there are the various camps, and you can tell the two different gothic horror fans which Dracula they gravitate towards. And I'm Lee too, the most explicit of all the Draculas, the most athletic, and the first one that had fangs, by the way, I should mention too. Prior to that, Lugosi never had fangs.
I did not know that.
Yeah, never had fangs. So no, I've never met Lee, and I'm happy to say that most of my heroes, living ones, obviously, to this day, no dead ones have made their appearance in my life, but I've met, or I've had some association with this to some degree, so I've been able to share my enthusiasm for their work in the flesh, which, again, is one of the great rewards of having this gig. But Lee has been my white whale. I haven't been able to get in touch with Lee, although I've been in touch with his people. We wanted to do a special one-off. I do this other line of Fangoria magazines called Fangoria Legends, which, you know, occasionally when we have the time, we spit them out, collector's items. And we wanted to do one with Lee, a little birthday party. And he wouldn't do it. And I think the chief reason for that is that Lee's legacy as Dracula is probably cast the longest shadow on his resume. And yet it's only a brief part of his resume. Lee's the kind of guy that lives in the now. He's well into his 80s. If not, maybe he's 90 now, actually. I don't have that information in front of me, but I think if he's not 90, he's almost 90. And yet he's still spry. He just released his second, I believe, heavy metal record over the holidays.
That I would like to hear.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I don't think he wants to muse anymore about his work in those Dracula films, because by and large, he was never really happy portraying Dracula. Hammer, and if you look at the Hammer movies, the Dracula films are actually, save for the first few, are kind of weak. They're not the greatest films, and they would just kind of, you know, churn these things out and get Lee into the cape, and some of them he didn't even have any dialogue. Dracula, Prince of Darkness, he's mute, and that was partially because he was protesting.
We're going to have to go to the mat on that one, Chris.
I mean, maybe. I mean, I love them. Don't get me wrong. I love these movies. They're fantastic. But they're not, as far as Hammer's output goes, they're, you know, they're franchise films. They're not the greatest. So,
well,
yeah,
the thing
Lee,
I noticed about, excuse me, but the thing I noticed about Christopher Lee as Dracula, not a lot of dialogue.
No, it's not a lot of dialogue because here's the thing. Now, the first movie, Horror of Dracula, 1958, he does have dialogue. He was very articulate and in your face, and very, it's a very violent film. It was very strong and very controversial for its time. by the time he made his second appearance as Dracula, and that was 1966 in Terence Fisher's Dracula, Prince of Darkness, the script, you know, a pretty good script, but the script called for certain lines of dialogue that had nothing to do with Bram Stoker's novel. And Lee, a bit of a snob, refused to say them. There was a particularly a line called where he's called to say, "I am the apocalypse," which to me sounds amazing. But Lee thought that was hokey and ridiculous. So in the story goes that in protest, Lee said, "Forget it, I'm not going to say anything." And so he played the role mute. And so if you watch
that's what happened.
Prince of Darkness, he doesn't say one word, not one word. And this carries on throughout the series. Dracula isn't prone to oration in those films at all. He just kind of shows up, does some stuff, fights somebody, and then dies, really. So Lee doesn't really like talking too much about those days, I don't think, you know?
But the mute Dracula works because it just made him all the more frightening.
Yes, he is sort of this, you know, serial killer, you know, this, you know, pre-Friday the 13th, he's kind of a more dapper Jason Voorhees or something in some of those films, certainly. Yeah.
No, I mean, Peter
listen,
Cushing?
I'm not saying I don't like those. I love those movies. I eat, sleep, and breathe those films. But they don't really, sometimes don't know quite what to do with Christopher Lee, let's be honest. They kind of wait.
What about Peter Cushing, who's another sort of stalwart of those Hammer films?
Yes. That face, that bone structure, that, you know, I can't think of one actor anywhere, anytime, that looks like Peter Cushing. You know, whatever mother he crawled out of, there was some unique DNA, some very strange cocktail going on there, because I can't think of anyone else who has that look and that presence. You know, they called Peter Cushing Props Cushing on set because he was always prone to improvising with mise-en-scene, with props that were in the film, and so he inhabited whatever frame he was in physically by working with whatever he had in front of him. So if you look at any Hammer film, watch Cushing's performance. He's always moving, and he's always touching things, and he's always engaging, sometimes looking at something while he's talking to somebody else, and that's all improv. That's all Cushing's method, done there on the spot without any direction. So Cushing was and still remains, you know, the icon of Hammer, really. I mean,
he played Van Helsing, of course, who was the vampire hunter. Were he and what kind of relationship did Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee have?
Well, it was a relationship of friendship. So, yes, he played Van Helsing and obviously Dr. Frankenstein, most famously in those superior Frankenstein films. But the two of them were not only colleagues and co-stars for several films, both within the folds of Hammer and without, but they were also dear friends. And I think that, you know, if you really want to study their relationship, the most profound moment in their joint careers came in 1970s Horror Express, which was not a Hammer film, which is a Spanish knockoff of Hammer. A period piece that cast Lee and Cushing as warring anthropologists. Meanwhile, Telly Savalas is a Cossack running around this Trans-Siberian Express. Very strange movie. But the thing was, if you look at Cushing in the late 60s compared to this film, he ages very quickly, and that's because his wife Helen died and left him completely destitute. He was just demolished by her passing and suicidal and became very morose and didn't want to work anymore. He just lost that spirit. And it was Lee on the cusp of filming Horror Express. Cushing was just about to drop out, and Lee went to visit him one evening and sat with him with this plan in mind to kind of rally his spirit. But instead of talking about the work, they just talked about the past and their friendship and the films that they started and the people they knew. And lo and behold, the next day, Lee was ready. He was on that plane ready to go and shoot Horror Express. And if you watch Horror Express, you will see when they share scenes, I see this relationship where Cushing brightens up when Lee's in the room with him when they're sharing a scene. So that friendship endured and thrived right until Cushing's dying day.
And I guess then we have Christopher Lee to thank for Peter Cushing sort of continuing his career, and then many a new generation of fans were able to see him in the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, that's right. If it wasn't for Lee, I mean, who knows what Peter may have died very quickly after that. But he didn't. He survived and thrived. And again, his second wave of his cult fandom was found starring in 1977 Star Wars, for sure. And the same thing happened with Lee, too. I mean, he found his other wave of fame starring in the second wave of Star Wars sequels, as well as starring as Saruman in the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, he's just absolutely brilliant.
And yeah.
I mean, he just, it's so captivating to see him on the big screen.
Yeah.
He has
like
such
I
a
said.
Presence.
Yeah,
such
inimitable.
A presence.
There's no one else like him.
Let's talk about the Twilight Zone. And I'd be curious because you sound like a reasonably young man, and I'm wondering how you found the Twilight Zone and what it meant to you and what it means to you.
Well, part of the crux of this book is not just an episode guide. It's a very personal episode guide. There already is an episode guide out there. You know, the first and last word in episode guides really called the Twilight Zone Companion. But it's a very analytical look at the show. Mine is not. Mine is very personal because I'm very, you know, my ties to the show are not just one of appreciation of the craft and of Serling's poetry, but, you know, the show is very much tied into my the warm nostalgia I have watching these reruns with my father in Toronto, where I'm based, late at night on a channel called City TV, and then to later on another channel called WGRZ out of Buffalo. It was the Cat's Pajamas. They'd run horror movies and Twilight Zone episodes and Death Valley Days of all things, which is very weird, but all night. So my childhood was steeped in exposing myself to, you know, macabre fantasy and pop culture as a child, and my father loved this stuff, so we shared that together. So yeah, I got my Twilight Zone reruns. It was, I think, really late at night. It was usually Sunday nights. At midnight, they'd have a double shot, or Sunday afternoons, you'd get that as well. And it was a thrill. And some of my friends were into it, too. So we'd have little kind of Twilight Zone parties, and we'd sit around, you know, on Sunday before school started in the afternoons and watch these shows and thrill and chill to them. You know, Twilight Zone always had that three-act format where you'd have the first act, second act, and then that stinger in the tail. And it was always that stinger in the tail that stuck with you and certainly informed a lot of my my love of this kind of bizarre stuff was all forged from those Twilight Zone episodes I saw as a child.
And when you look at the 5 years of the five seasons of the Twilight Zone, how did it change? I mean, it started out as a half hour, and then at some point it became an hour format.
Yeah. Listen, Serling was a little backstory about Serling, and I'm sure your listeners, if you're a fan, this is all common knowledge. But Serling, before he pitched and was able to get the green light to make the Twilight Zone for CBS, he was considered, you know, television was an art form at the time, you know, live theater shot right in front of you, performed live in your living room. And, you know, he'd won Emmys for Requiem for a Heavyweight with Jack Palance, one of the masterpieces of early television.
Right. I mean, it was Rod Serling and Paddy Chayefsky.
Yes, with the guys. Yes, exactly. So he was considered, you know, an A-list writer. You know, he was a very serious writer, a moralist. And so making a show about science fiction and horror and fantasy was deemed kind of by his admirers kind of a step down, a bit of a ghetto enterprise, which is unfortunate. But the reason he did this was because he ran into some trouble after Requiem for a Heavyweight in telling the stories he wanted to tell. You know, he deemed racism being the biggest social evil ever and the root of all social evils, really. And yet it was a taboo subject that he could not seemingly address head on television. So he conceived of the Twilight Zone as a way to, you know, I think the famous line he said later on was that the point of the Twilight Zone is he could make aliens and robots say things that Republicans and Democrats could not on television. And yet he had to hide that. There's a famous interview he has with Mike Wallace that you can find on YouTube, right on the cusp of the airing of the first episode of The Twilight Zone, where he discusses the show, and he pretends that, no, this show has no ulterior motive. It is not allegorical. It is not metaphorical. It is simply a science fiction and fantasy program. That's all it is. Of course, that was not the case, and very quickly audiences latched on to the fact that these were stories about morality and war and death and fear and racism and xenophobia that were hiding under the guise of pulp fantasy. So very interesting writer. I think one of the greatest writers in history, and certainly Twilight Zone. To me, Twilight Zone, I always say that it's like sex for men. In the sense that even the bad episodes, there's no bad episodes. You're just happy to get any of them. It's all good.
Yes, true enough. Chris Alexander is with us, editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine. And we'll continue to talk about The Twilight Zone and Rod Serling. We'll also open up the phone lines when we come back. If you're a member of the KISS Army, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to talk about The Twilight Zone or the Hammer films or Bela Lugosi, Peter Cushing, Lon Chaney Jr., Chris Alexander is the guy. All right, back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie.